Okay, there we are. Now we're recording. Eureka, all the talks are done. Only half of them were there anyway. So he says here in number four, in spiritual maxim number four from the practice of the presence of God, Brother Lawrence, actually this is a separate writing, the spiritual maxims. Number four, a soul is the more dependent on grace, the higher the perfection to which it aspires. And the grace of God is the more needful for each moment, as without it the soul can do nothing. Mm. Yeah. So that's very interesting. If the car, if you go out to the car and it won't start.
I'm not going to tell you anything anymore.
And it won't start. What's missing? The fuel, right? Or the impetus to make it go? The fuel.
The fog.
So what is, this is a very interesting perspective. It's brand new to me. I like what it's doing already in my mind.
I'm glad I inspire you.
That God, that what is the fuel for spiritual growth, according to this verse?
Grace.
Grace is the fuel for spiritual growth.
So where do we go get the grace? We pray for it?
The grace is always present. The wind is always blowing. Hoist your sail. What does that mean? Lift yourself out of the reasons that you're not good enough. Lift yourself out of the reasons that are all the list of troubles that make you unspiritual. Hoist your sail to lift yourself out of all of the negative ideas you have about yourself. Hoist your sail to release you from the assumptions of being separate from God. Hoist your sail and know that it's a lie that God is not present, that God is blocking himself from you. It is never God blocking him or herself from you. It is always you blocking yourself from God. It is grace that's going to give you permission to stop. And that to the degree that you can ingest and digest that sense of grace, which is what is grace? Grace is your understanding of unconditioned love. To the extent that you understand unconditioned love, to that extent you're growing in grace. Right? And by knowing, by ingesting and digesting God's unconditioned love for you, that gives your soul the power to transcend.
Say it again.
I don't know if I can. By ingesting and digesting the notion of unconditioned love for you from God.
Believing, is that what ingesting, digesting?
Much more than believing, because you can believe something and have no idea what it means. But ingesting and digesting means really contemplating, what does it mean that God loves me without condition? Mm-hmm. You know, what does that mean? And the first level is you get a sense of permission, like, oh, I get a license. I can do anything I want because God loves me unconditionally. That's very true. But it's not yet digested, because the soul who understands what that means can't live in any way but a perfect way. If you understand that grace, you don't blow it off cheaply. You don't then just use it as an impetus to do what you want. It becomes a source of inspiration. And that allows you to become what you are and not what you want. So he's saying here that the more that a soul is more dependent on grace, the higher to perfection to which it aspires. So your attainment is your understanding of grace. You know, your attainment in spiritual life is your understanding of grace. That is the fuel that launches your rocket to the beloved. Because it says, without it, the soul can do only a little bit. Now, what's it say there? The soul can do nothing. All right? That's a very good thing to contemplate. You can do nothing. You don't have to jump 6 inches. You don't have to attain a certain level. You can do nothing unless what?
Grace is there.
Unless what is happening is inspired by grace. Because if it's not inspired by grace, you will maintain the sense of agency.
Yes.
And what does the sense of agency, who's driving that car? Ego. That's right. Ego is driving that car. So we don't want our spiritual life to become associated with our sense of agency, because then we get that problem we started off talking about, which is that spiritual pride, where our spiritual accomplishments become the thing that block our vision of the beloved. We become proud of becoming good meditators, proud of doing so much practice, proud of always being at the center, whatever, you know. And that's not what we want. That's not being inspired by grace. That's not digesting unconditioned love. We are in the beautiful space of having been given the promise and the reality of an unconditioned love that is more profound and more deep than what our mind will ever be able to understand. But even the attempt is what makes us pure. Even the recollection is what makes us holy. Not anything that we're doing, just simply becoming aware of this infinite source of spiritual fuel. This infinite source of spiritual fuel, which is the grace of our beloved. So we hold on to that. The higher we want to go, the more we're going to need that grace. It is the wind beneath your wings. All right, Bette Midler.
That could be a song.
That could be a good song, wouldn't it? Something about you are the wind beneath my wings. Yeah. You better write it, Jan.
Yeah, right.
So this idea, the world, the flesh, and the devil join forces and assault the soul so straitly and so untiringly that, without humble reliance on the ever-present aid of God, they drag the soul down in spite of all resistance. Mm. Okay, God, this is beautiful here. Mm. So everything's conspiring. Now, really, this is very interesting. What is actually the flesh, the devil, and the world conspiring you to do? This is kind of a fun one. Mm-hmm. It's to live for the short term. Mm-hmm. Live for what makes you happy now.
Oh.
You know, which is how we get...
expecting happiness
expect,
all the time.
Yeah, based on what you're doing. You know, it's... You know, if you like, the body and mind will conspire to have you eat that piece of cake right now, mm-hmm. because that's what's going to make you happy.
Yes.
But tomorrow morning when you wake up, having eaten that piece of cake today is not going to make you happy, right? So the body, the mind, is always conspiring to have you live without regard of the long term, without regard of samskaras and bad habits and unholy giving and doing. So it bases your joy on the moment. Mm-hmm. The wise man, you know, does what he knows will make him happy in the morning. Mm-hmm. Because he knows the morning is his inevitable experience. So if you live for what makes you happy in the morning, you'll have a happier life overall.
Mm-hmm. What's the morning signify?
The results of your actions, and not just the temporary pleasure that comes from your actions. That's the building on the sand versus building on the rock. If you build on the sand, the things of the changing, the things that bring pleasure, the things that, you know, that you can manipulate in the world. If you build your joy and contentment on those things, you'll always be building. There's no stability there. Because the mind always changes, so even if it's happy this moment because you are wearing a purple hat, it's not going to be happy in the morning because you're wearing a purple hat. It's going to want a blue one. So you don't live to please the mind because you become a slave, because the mind will constantly come up with demands that you have to perform to keep it happy. And you can't live for the happiness and contentment of the body, because the body's just going to come up with a string of requirements. So that's why they call it bondage, because you are, in fact, in bondage.
Very much so.
All the time. constantly having, oh, the house has to be this temperature. Oh, the weather has to be like this outside. Oh, my schedule has to be like this. Oh, my friends have to act like this. Oh, my kids have to act like that. And they never do. Uh-huh. How can you get a whole orchestra of things and people to live the way you want them to live? Not going to happen, right? So that's building on the sand. That's being the foolish man. You're never going to find contentment, and your house will never stand if you build by serving mind and body to keep yourself happy. Not going to work. So you build on the rock. What is building on the rock? Building on grace. Building on the love. Your nature, Satchitananda. Doing things that love does. Doing things that intelligence does. Opening to the experience of being. And be inspired by the awesomeness of that, the profundity of it. If you build on those things during your day, if you worry about those things, your joy will be infinitely deep, it will be profound, and it will be unshakable, because you're building on the unchanging, that part of you which never changes, the part of you that loves love for its own sake. It loves to give love, it loves to receive love, it loves to watch love, it loves to identify love, all of that. So he's talking about that here. He says, the world, the flesh, the devil, they join forces, you know, and assault the soul so straightly and so untiringly that without humble reliance on the ever-present aid of God, that's very important. The ever-present aid of God. All right. Yeah, if something is ever-present, you don't even have to go get it. It's right here. Use it. All right. And he says here that the world, the flesh, and the devil join forces and assault the soul so straightly and untiringly. There's only one way that that's not true. That's if you mean what you say. That's why truth, remember, truth is that inner integrity, that inner alignment between what you say, what you do, and what you think.
Sincerity.
Yeah, that depth, that alignment, that integrity. If you say no to the body or to the mind and mean it, which means those three things are in alignment, what you're saying, what you're doing, and what you're thinking are in alignment, there's no more conversation. You've won the war. If, however, you perceive it as a battle, you're going to lose. Because in order to have a battle, you have to have an enemy. And in order for you to have an enemy, you're going to have to become two people. One of you is going to want the forbidden thing, and one of you is not going to want the forbidden thing, and you're going to battle it out.
Oh, dear.
If you've come into that state,
wow,
you divided yourself into two people, which means you've abandoned truth. You're
it's
no
longer like sugar craving, for example.
Yeah.
Should I eat that cookie?
Yeah. If you say no and mean it, then you don't eat the cookie, and there's no more battle. Mm-hmm. I said no. Doesn't exist for me in the world anymore. When Swami Prabhutananda, whenever the doctor changed, by the end of his life, he was eating almost nothing. The doctor had forbidden everything for him. And it meant it was nothing for Swami Prabhutananda. If the doctor said no more cheese literally did not exist for him. Literally just did not exist. You know. And so that's the secret to these things. It's like, know that you mean it. I'm not going to eat any more chocolate. Mm. There's not a question. There's not a discussion. There's not an argument. That's the fact. Done. Finished. If you can have that kind of resolve, that kind of renunciation, then your realization of God is 15 minutes away or less.
That's renunciation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That is the definition of renunciation, yeah. And to have a strong renunciation. That's what strong renunciation is. Yeah. To say it and mean it. To have that truth, which is one of the three most important things. Have that alignment inside so that you know when you say no, you mean no. It means there's no conversation. The mind will always want to bring it into conversation.
Yes.
Oh, come on, you haven't had a piece of chocolate in 6 weeks. You can have one now.
In 6 minutes.
You know, and then you start engaging with that idea, and before you know it, you're sitting in the bathroom with a big box of chocolates, hoping nobody walks in on you, because you're terribly ashamed. So you don't do it. You take the ever-present help of God. If it's God's help, certainly it's enough. So that eliminates all excuses for why you're going to need that piece of chocolate. Nope, I have the power of the divine here. And so I sit in that power. And I have the resolution of truth. I'm committed to my truth. I'm walking away from this. I'm done.
How do you make your mind that strong with your food restrictions? So you are using that.
Oh, very much. I am, and I've tried some new things. I've tried some that are working. Like when I first, usually when I do a diet like this, it never lasts because I can't bear the thought of never again. So I would never use the word never again. I'd be like, I'm on a diet for X period of time, and then I'll have my chocolate, I'll have my sugar, I'll have my whatever. For the first time, this going into this, I stared at it straight in the face, and for the first time, I looked at that cookie, and I said, no, never again. Never again. So don't even bring it up. And that has worked so much better than leaving a space of permission in there.
Yeah.
Oh, at some point I can have the cookie, not now. Yeah. Then every time, yeah, I consciously put coffee back in my list. But no, and that's fair.
That's a good strategy.
No, it works.
Never again.
Never again. And to hold that line, it's so, the way that it happens, you see, is if you do it once, it's easier to do it the second time.
Yes.
If you do it the second time, it's significantly easier to do it the third time. Why? Because your mind is beginning to understand that you're driving the car and that it's not driving the car. It's just like having a good parent. A good parent, you never quite know whether they mean it or not. They say yes this time, they say no that time, they say yes this time, that time. Oh, okay, go ahead. You know, at the department store. But like my mother, if she told me I wasn't going to get that cookie in the grocery line, there was no tantrum that was going to be big enough to get that cookie. I knew that. And so I knew. I didn't ask again. If Ma said no, I wasn't going to get the cookie, period. So you have to be that way with yourself. You're the parent. Your mind is your disciple. It's your toddler. And when you tell it something, do you mean it? Because your mind, like a toddler, is going to test your boundaries. Oh, how much does she mean that? Does that really mean I can't have a cookie?
Yeah, but if you're telling your mind that, that means your mind is telling your mind?
Yeah.
Because who are you to tell your mind?
That's a good meditation right there. Through that, you will come to realize the nature of things. Because the delusion is that we're listening to our own mind and having a conversation and living our life accordingly. That's the delusion. The reality is that we are the hearer. God is the one watching and listening to the senses and the mind.
Yeah.
His eternal presence. We have assumed that existence. We've put that on it, said that's me, and run off and kind of just stole the car for a joyride.
Yeah.
So we've stolen the body and mind from the beloved for our joyride. Mm-hmm. And so we have to give that back ultimately. And giving that back is coming to the realization that there are not two birds in the tree. There is not the ever-perfect, ever-secure self at the top of the tree. There's no second bird at the bottom of the tree. You've created those two to rob the body and mind from God, to steal the experience from the beloved. And so what we're trying to do is come to realization, which is there's only one here, and that's the beloved living a life of love through this experience.
That's like a helpful image.
Yeah.
The ego stealing.
Yeah, and that's all it's doing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all it's doing.
Swamiji?
Yes, ma'am.
Sorry to disturb.
No worries.
We were talking about self-control and you gave the cookie example.
Yeah.
But is it always the mind that wants, or there may be physiological needs that create that urge to have something?
Right. Well, it's a combination. First, everything is mind. Okay, but the thing that's informing the mind at that point, what you're talking about, would be the body and senses. So the body and senses are informing the mind, You've put your identity in the mind, and if you're building on the sand, then you're taking in consideration the body and mind for your decision.
I think she might mean something like a hypoglycemic situation.
Yeah, same thing. Same thing. It's all perception. Perceptions come through the mind. Yeah. Did that answer, or is the question still there?
I'll have to hash it out.
Okay. But yeah, so the body informs the mind, and the mind informs you, the watcher, the one who's watching. And so the body, if the body needs sugar, it's going to put up a flag that says, hey, mind, I need sugar. And the mind's going to turn to you and say, hey, you know, the body says it needs sugar. Should we get some? And you sit there and think, oh, no, I've renounced sugar. No, sorry, you don't get any sugar. Oh, but we're hungry. Okay, well, you can have a date. You can have a fig, you know, like that.
Hmm.
So it's a consortium, but you are always trying to keep the unchanging as your pole in the middle. It's what you're holding on to. You don't stray from Satchitananda.
Okay.
Yes. The world, the flesh, and the devil join forces, assault the soul so straightly, they come directly at it, and so untiringly, and that's the thing, that's where most of us fail.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a big assumption on my part. That's where I fail. I'll have strength to say no the first 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And the 4th time, I'm so frustrated with saying no. I'm like, oh, fine.
I'll go ahead.
But you only say no more than once when you don't mean it the first time. The body only asks a second time because you have a history of not meaning what you say. You go into battle. What happens is you instead of having your no be no and your yes yes, you break yourself into those 2 components, and then you have to go into battle. The only reason you're going into battle is so you can lose. I'll tell you up front. The only reason you're going into battle is so you can lose. Now, why do you need the battle then? Because you need the battle long enough to where you felt like you've put up a good enough fight to not be guilty, so that you can be the victim, and then you can do your thing, have your cake, and then apologize to God later. That's the schema of delusion. That's the schema of delusion.
That's profound. Say it again.
That when the temptation comes, whatever it is, the thing that's going to work against you, if you don't have your no, no, and your yes, yes, you allow yourself to go into battle, you have only done that because you know you're going to lose. And you're only going to fight that battle long enough to justify the loss. Oh, I really tried.
You know, you are so right. Can I give an example?
Sure.
I mean, not a personal thing that way. Like, you know, if that we are having food here, right?
Mm-hmm.
If Swami A says no, I dare not even ask him again, do you want more? Really, I'm scared of him. Swami C, he says no. I said, come on, Swami G. And he just say a couple of times, he says, okay, little bit. So you are so right. Because the no that our mind is saying is not powerful enough. That's why.
Yeah.
You're so right.
Yeah. And that's why that's one of the three most important things, right? That truth, that inner alignment, what you say, what you think, and what you do.
Yeah.
If you live a life where those 3 things are in alignment, a life of truth, that's where the power comes from that eliminates battle. That's where the no comes from that there is no follow-up to. No.
Maharaj, can I just tell a story?
Mm.
That little girl I was talking about, she asked her mother for a donut, and the mother said no. So she went to the babysitter and said, some name, I don't remember, if I eat all my food, I finish my chicken, then I can have a donut, right? Mother was standing there and the babysitter was standing there. She didn't know what to say. Unfortunately, she didn't get the donut.
No, very fortunately that she did not get it. That was a good thing. But think about that dynamic too, though. You know, that's a matter of who you consider to be in charge, right? If you can't get it from this one, you go to that parent. Mm-hmm. In third grade, I had two teachers for third grade, and the class was huge with two teachers. And it was funny because sometimes they would split the cast down the middle and all the people on that side would face that direction and then everybody else would face this direction. And Mrs. Manning was here and Mrs. Bouchard was over there. Now, Mrs. Manning didn't like me. Mrs. Bouchard loved me. All right? I got in so much trouble because if I would ask something for Mrs. Bouchard and she said no, I would turn around and go ask Mrs. Manning and she would say yes or vice versa. I can't remember. But anyway, I was always in trouble until my parent-teacher conference that year. Uh-oh. That was their big complaint, is that I would always play the two teachers against each other. So we have to be careful in our own mind. Is your whole self dedicated to Thakur and your ideal? Or do you have some other little form of authority in there that's dedicated to pleasure? You know, who you know is going to give you what you asked for. And who do you go to? Who are you serving? Yes, these are all good ways.
You were a challenge, weren't you?
Were. God bless you for saying were. I was a challenge. Yeah, one time I was a challenge.
Another example, I like to go at 6 o'clock to do my japam.
Uh-huh.
And that's the hardest time, 6:01, and I'm trying to battle. And then, you know, the other day, say, oh, I just did 108 names of Shiva. You can go at 6:30. But I was talking to myself. And just like you said, the child playing the two teachers,
mm-hmm.
I'm doing it with my mind.
That's it. That's it. You see, you're starting to understand why Thakur says that single-minded focus. This is exactly what he's talking about. Become a single person. Become a single person. That's when Thakur makes that statement that, you know, unless all of the desires are taken care of, you'll never be able to thread the needle. If there's even one fiber sticking out,
yeah.
As long as you are not a single person in any way, you can't thread the needle. You can't have your realization. The Maya continues. You have to become single. You have to become one person. You can't become these. You can't keep giving mind its own identity that you interact with. That's your power that you're giving to the mind to have it interact with you. You can't divide your power. You have to stay singular. And you have to stay true to that which does not change, that Satchitananda. Do not serve the things that change. Okay? That's what he's saying here.
Mm.
And he says the way that you break that cycle is with an absolute understanding of grace. That's what inspires you, forgives you, takes off the bondage, you know, allows you to transcend your karma. Allows you to transcend your karma. So, assault the soul so strictly and so untiringly that without humble reliance on the ever-present aid of God, they drag the soul down in spite of all resistance. Thus, to rely seems hard to nature, but grace makes it become easy and brings with it
joy.
Okay?
Wow.
If you're doing your practice right, it brings joy. If you're doing your practice right, it brings joy. That's a very important thing. You know, if our practice has become drudgery, if our practice has become something we want to get out of the way so that we can, you know, play our video game or whatever it is, then we're not doing it right. We've forgotten something very, very important.
Oh, it's something to look forward to.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It should be the thing. People, these sadhus that are meditating, you know, 6-8 hours a day, they're not doing it out of drudgery. They're doing it because they've touched something beautiful they don't want to get away from. They want to be established in that. You know, they want to make it their own. And so for us, our practice, you know, doesn't have to always be entertaining, but in a general way, it should be a great joy, a source of great peace for us,
mm-hmm.
great love.
When, say, others come to your house who are not, you know, into this, and it's 6 o'clock. So I try to do it earlier. Is that okay? Because they're there. You know, other people are there who are not into it.
Yeah, it's a compromise, and you make the rules about what's okay and what's not okay. So it's up to you. If you have made the decision ahead of time, oh, tonight, as an exception, these people are coming to my house, I'm going to do my practice at 5:30, mm-hmm. and you go do your practice at 5:30. That's a decision and a consciously made one and can be healthy. Now, if it's not consciously made, your friends are always showing up at 6 o'clock and you're like, oh, it's okay, I can do it some other time. And it doesn't stay fixed and the commitment begins to waver and you start finding that you're enjoying lots of company at 6 o'clock and never really having a good meditation, then it's not okay. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing too is to always say, okay, Thakur, my gosh, these people are coming over. I know it's my time for meditation, but this is the circumstance you've put before me. Help me make this a spiritual moment with these people. I commit myself here to see you in their faces. I commit myself here to serve all that I would serve you with to them. So when I bring them cookies, when I bring them punch, when I bring them mm-hmm. popcorn, please keep it in my mind and keep my eye on the fact that I'm bringing it to you. So you turn the circumstance into practice. Mm-hmm. You know.
Can I just add one other thing?
Yeah.
Besides all the things I'm talking about. So this woman who comes to help me, she's a teacher. So, you know, she brought, you know, we were eating, and I looked at the food, and my hand was right there trying to get it. And she said, Rina, you can start your prayer. And she reminded me. So we both sat there, she listened, and I said, Brahmarpana. That was so, you know, that's grace.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
That's Thakur reminding me that I forgot.
Yeah, that's
Mohan, can I pray to Thakur Ma to give me the strength so that I become more, what should I say?
Have the grace.
So that I love Thakur and Ma more.
You're just tasting.
Yeah, you can. I wouldn't ask that way.
Okay.
Because they already have given you that.
You ask
Ma, can I access, please teach me to access the love for you that I have. Please help me to recognize that I have no other love but love for you. You know? So it's kind of like that. It's like always come to an understanding that all you need, you're not a beggar. You're not a beggar, you're the heir. So all of this is yours already. You don't have to beg for it. What you have to do is accept it. Mm. Mother, help me accept the fact that I have enough strength to never make this mistake again.
Then what is the meaning of Sri Ramakrishna saying, Mother, give me true bhakti?
Same thing, you know. Yeah, we'd have to dig out his prayers. Kind of look at how he uses it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's a statement of desire, you know. But he also teaches that. I mean, he says that our goal is to combine those three loves, the love that a rich man has for his wealth, the love a man has for his chaste wife, and a love for mother for her child. That's the three loves, right? Anyway, he says that you have to unify that into a single love. Now, does that mean you have to stop loving your kids, stop loving money, and stop loving all of that? In a way, yes, but no. What he's saying there is come to the realization and understanding that what you find pleasing in money is the beloved who stands behind it. Understand that the love you have for your wife is the love for the beloved that stands behind it. Understand that your love for your child is because of the presence of the beloved that stands behind it. And through that understanding, the three loves become unified because you realize that the three separate things are only symbols of the beloved. What is it that you love in money? A sense of security, a sense of enablement, a sense of power. Are those not direct names of the beloved, security, power, you know. What is it that you're looking for in your child? That sweet love, that connection, you know, that need and fulfillment, that all of these things, again, all of them names of God. What are you looking for in a wife or a husband? Companionship, security, you know, whatever it is you were looking for there. It's not that you have to give up the love of those things. What it is that you have to expand your understanding of the love that's being expressed to know that your husband or wife, that your child, that your money are only symbols of the beloved. Stop loving the symbols and understand that what you love is that which the symbol indicates. And that unifies your love. And your husband still stays loved, your children still stay loved, and your bills still stay paid in that way, you know? So that's... Thus to rely seems hard to nature, but grace makes it become easy and brings it with joy. To rely seems hard to nature, so to the body and mind, surrender seems hard. You know, so if your practice is hard, it's because you're putting your eye heavily on the side of body-mind. You know, bring your eye, because that's really where our power is. That's the same notion. Gathering your power is also centralizing your eye. All right? Put your eye entirely on Satchitananda. Pull back the distributions that you've put on body and mind. You know, because it's the distributions that you've given to body and mind, the power that you've shared with body and mind, that allows it to have an opinion. Because your body doesn't have an opinion. It's when you break yourself into a piece and you give some of that power to your body that it has an opinion. Your mind doesn't have an opinion. You are the sole power of the mind. It's your opinion that counts. But if you break yourself into a pieces and you give part of yourself to mind, then mind has an opinion. And if you have a body with an opinion and a mind with an opinion and then a self with an opinion, you've got a three-way war going on. And that's what he's talking about here. Nature will find it difficult. You know, you'll find yourself on a battlefield. Don't want to be on a battlefield. So pull yourself into Satchitananda. Pull yourself out of mind. Take your permission away from the body. And centralize it on the unchanging self, build on the rock, and you will not fall. Simple as that. You simply will not fall. Because the power of God is ever present, ever available. And his requirement to you is unconditioned, which means it's yours for the asking, it's yours for the taking. So if you pray for power to overcome your obstacle, and you don't overcome the obstacle, it's not because God didn't give you the power to overcome. It's because you didn't take it. It was there, and you didn't take it. And what does that mean? Does that mean you go around flogging yourself? No, it means be honest, truthfulness. Be honest and say, wow, I wanted that more than I wanted my inner peace. That's troublesome. I should think about that, because if I really do make that compromise official, will I find inner peace? Will I be joyful? All right, let's go ahead and break into the next session here, of necessary practices for attaining to the spiritual life. This will be interesting. That practice which is alike the most holy, the most general, and the most needful in the spiritual life is the practice of the presence of God. Yeah. Yeah. Let's break that down. The most holy, right? God is the absolute pinnacle of holiness. So if you want a room to be holy, consciously bring the presence of God into it. If you want a mind that is holy, bring the presence of the beloved into it. If you want a body that is holy, put it in the presence of the beloved. That is the only holiness that there is. So when you go into a temple, a and you feel great holiness there, a great atmosphere. We all like to say, oh, this place has such a nice atmosphere. No. God is present.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God is present. I'm aware of the presence of the Beloved here. That's what makes it holy. You know, nothing, no other mystery. It's the presence of the Beloved. The most general. Why? God is everywhere present. How can you get more general than that? And why is it important that God be general? Because we're asked to engage in all kinds of things all day long. If we don't see God in each one of them, then we get pulled out of our remembrance of the Beloved all
the
time.
What does the general mean?
Just in the broadest sense, you know, that the most open mind, a wide open mind, seeing God in all things, serving God everywhere, continually. We don't have conditions for being spiritual. We don't have to be in a church. We don't have to be reading the scriptures. We don't have to be meditating. In our deepest and most general way, we are experiencing the holiness of all things because we're mindfully keeping our mind in the awareness of the Beloved, in the presence of God. And the most needful. Why the most needful? Because he got just finished telling you, you can do nothing without God. If God removes that listener within, you die. You cease. You're not there anymore. You know, you're lower up, gone. You know? So live in the presence. Live in the presence. And use this idea that right now all of your thinking is being watched by God. That shows you how intimate your relationship with God is. You see, God has told us that he's so close that he can hear the anklets on an ant. And the other one is that he's closer to you than your own neck. And yet when we say God is the listener of your thoughts, that brings surprise. Oh gosh. Mm-hmm. But what do you think those scriptures are trying to tell you? God is more intimate to you than you are. Because he alone is real. Your idea of yourself is fake. So how close to yourself can you be? You know, you that existence is make-believe. So the divine's presence in you is what is you. It's what wakes you up. It's what inspires you. It's what's watching your mind and making the contents of your mind important. It's what's making the things in your life of value. You know, without that presence, there is no value. Without that watcher, without God being the watcher of mind, there's no understanding. You could hear the words go across the screen, but you couldn't give meaning to them. Because God is the intelligence that gives your words meaning. The people in your life that you love, without the presence of the Beloved, there would be no love in you. God is that Satchitananda in you. So you're using his love to love. You're using his love to recognize love. You're using his intelligence to understand the contents of your mind. You're using his intelligence. You're using his intelligence to understand the body. It's the way the body communicates with you. Without that intelligence, you wouldn't know what the body needed. You would feel pain and you wouldn't be able to discern a need because there's no intelligence. You would feel hunger and not know how to take care of it because intelligence is not there. You know, so that is the presence of God, and we experience him intimately. Because what don't you do where value and understanding are required? And you cannot produce value without the presence of God. You cannot produce understanding without the presence of God. So coming to an awareness of that is a way of keeping yourself in the presence of God. Keeping yourself aware of the fact that you need him utterly. Utterly.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing without it, without that. In there. It is the schooling of the soul to find its joy in his divine companionship. See, okay. That's that thing. That's what is this? To find its joy in his divine companionship. That is being true to Satchitananda, your nature. That's the image of the Beloved that he's given you. To live and to be true, to find your joy in his divine companionship, is to find joy in the fact that you are that very image of God. So doing things for love, doing things for intelligence, doing things that celebrate existence, the manifestation of that, That's the schooling of the mind that we're trying to do. Mind, take delight in giving. Take delight in serving. Don't take delight in pleasure. Take delight in value, in how important things are. Invest in those things. How do you invest in love? I think the thing I learned, one of the ways I've learned the most about this, and I've talked about it a lot, in San Francisco, you know, I was the only brahmachari, so I got all the fun work to do. And one of my absolute favorite jobs was five times a year, we would have a worship in the monastery shrine.
Okay.
And it would take me about 8 hours to do the shrine work. That, you know, when there were other brahmacharis there, we would all do it together. It was great fun. When they all went away and it was just me, oh God, I'd have to spend the whole day, and I'd have to go through, and we had our own traditions. So like every blind on the Venetian blinds, you know, and we had three of them in the room. Every one of them had to be washed individually and then dried individually. You know,
you would take it out and put it back.
And then the windows had to be washed inside, and then I had to go outside and put a ladder up and wash the outside, and then all of the brass that was in the cabinet, most of which we never used, all of that had to come out and be polished, and then when it was out, all the shelves had to be wiped down and all the shelf paper had to be replaced. And then we had that wonderful shrine made in the United States, but it was all the Indian curlicues and gingerbread all over it. So I would have to fold a napkin in a particular way so I could get in and clean all the little scroll work and all the little individual lotuses. Why do I say all that? To make you understand how much there was to do and how long it took me to do it, and what a bad attitude I had about it for most of the time. Because I was like, oh my God. But how I grew to enjoy it, to appreciate it, was the next morning when I got to do the worship. And when you sit down in a room that you have been intimately cleaning for 8 hours, intimately decorating with flowers and perfumes and incense and garlands, and you sit down and you've got all the foods that you've prepared and have been arranging, and you sit down and you do that worship, you suddenly understand exactly what this life is about, because that investment was karma yoga. It was doing work for literally no purpose from a worldly perspective. You know, what did all of that do? What all of that did was invest my heart, invest my life, invest my thought, and invest my effort into the shrine to prepare for a worship. And when I sat down to do that worship and sat in that environment, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful satisfaction. And that's what comes to your life. That's what comes to your life. If you invest yourself in your life with love, your life becomes profoundly important, profoundly beautiful to you. It's that investment of self into love that creates a fulfilling and holy life. So what does that mean? It means just that. You know, when you decorate your home, put love into it. When you clean your house, clean it with love. Don't just do things to get it done. You know, invest. Invest. Invest your energy, invest your awareness, invest your presence. Be fully there as you do anything. And that environment takes on a value because you've become aware of God in it. You know, to live like that is really important. It's really important to be that meticulous and that careful. That's where this joy comes from that he says accompanies real spiritual life. It is the schooling of the soul to find its joy in his divine companionship, holding with him at all times and at every moment, humble and loving converse, okay? Holy and loving conversation. That's giving God a permanent place in your mind, so that you're constantly aware that every thought goes in front of him or her. every decision is made in front of him or her, that every thought of your mind is before the beloved. And if you live in that awareness, you don't think that you're going to become holy? Mm-hmm. If you become aware of God's watching this thought as much as I am, mm. Do I want to keep holding on to it or not? You know? So he's saying here, and look at how he's telling us to do this, holding with him at all times and at every moment. Is that not saying the same thing? So he's saying it twice. At all times. But do I have to do it when I'm... Oh, but should I do it when I'm... Mm-mm. It's not unclear. Mm-mm-mm. It's not unclear. Holding with him at all times and at every moment, humble and loving converse, without set rule or stated method. That's lovely. That's radical. That's radical. You don't have to do it in a particular way. God is your very own. Swami Prabuddhananda taught me to do worship that way. And it's one of my favorite things. He said that the structure of the worship is just a skeleton. He said it's up to you to hang your devotion all over it. You can repeat your own poems. You can sing your own songs. You can create your own additional little rituals or the little twist in the way that you do particular rituals. Make it your own. It is your love letter to the beloved. That is your worship. Be free in it. Not free to cut corners, that's not the freedom we're talking about. The freedom to give more. The freedom to do it more carefully. The freedom to lose yourself in that worship. Without set rule or stated method, in all time of our temptation and tribulation. All right? So, when you're sitting there fighting the hardest, you know, God is present. You blame the victory. God is here. I can't lose this battle. You see, you use that grace, you use that presence to strengthen that unity of I. To strengthen that unity of I. God says that his power is always present. I've asked for his help in this. If I fail this, it's because I didn't use the power that's available. If I don't do this, it's because I chose not to do it, not because I'm not able to do it. In all time of our temptation and tribulation, in all time of our dryness of soul and disrelish of God. Oh, so yeah, wow, he's willing to admit that there's times when the mind doesn't want to think about God. Usually, when is it?
When you're attracted by something else.
Yeah, when you want to be mischievous. When you want to build on the sand a little bit. You don't want to build on the rock. I want that piece of cake. Mm. Damn it. When it comes to that, that's the time to put the mind on God even more. Drag mother into the middle of it. No matter what it is, drag mother into the middle of it. You know, it's one of the beautiful things that Thakur taught to M. You know, I'm going to bring this is statement 143, my favorite statement. You know, where when M was an alcoholic, he was a drunk, and God never told him to stop drinking.
Girish.
Sorry, who did I say? Oh, sorry. Yeah, M's a drunk. You heard it here. Yeah. We might have to edit the tape on that one. No, Girish Ghosh, yeah. Of course. So Girish was a drunk. Thakur never told him to stop drinking. What was his teaching? Before you take that first sip of red wine, hold that glass up and thank Mother for the joy that you think you're getting from it. What's he teaching? Exactly what Brother Lawrence is saying here. Bring the awareness of God into all of your activities, whether they're vice or virtue. Whether they're vice or virtue.
Yeah.
it's difficult to bring mother when I'm doing something that I'm not supposed to do.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the point. The way that you've become comfortable with your vice is by ignoring God.
What, eating chocolate?
Whatever it is, yeah, even something that simple, you know. Yeah, if the way that we become comfortable with vice is by removing God. It's the only way we can be. You can't be comfortable as a drunk with the awareness of God at the same time. You might be able to get that drink down today, but tomorrow that thought of God's going to be a little bit stronger. And the next day it's going to be a little bit stronger. And then one day you're going to be like, you know what, today I think I'm just going to sit with you. I'm not going to have the drink. I'm going to leave it right there in the shrine for you. You know, and you have your first day without a drink. And look what happened to Girish. He became a saint. You know, became a saint. So that's the thing. We don't focus on the sin in our life. We don't focus on our shortcomings. We don't let them build up and tear ourselves down over them. We don't. We bring God into the picture and we watch them disappear. Because it's harder and harder to maintain them the more and more you think of God. And pretty soon you realize that it was the pleasure that you're getting from the thought of God that you were looking for in your vice anyway. And we get taught, we learn, and we grow. So those times, you know, without rules and stated methods, so there's lots of room for play with the beloved. In the time of your temptation and tribulation, so when your mind is being distracted, that's the time even more. Share that distraction with God, you know. Share that distraction. I remember when I first joined the monastery, to be out for a walk, I'd see a beautiful person. You know, those thoughts would be there, want to be there. How do they stop? How do they stop? You bring in mother. Mother, you look fantastic today. Oh, mother, that sari looks amazing on you. What fantastic colors. You know, you bring mother in. And that way you can appreciate the beauty. You don't have to squelch it or deny it or, you know, repress it. You express it, give glory to the mother, and move on. Don't get stuck. So it's like that. Mother, you could not have made a more delicious piece of chocolate. I think I'm going to go and give it to my friend. I'm going to go and put it on the shrine.
And I am my best friend.
And I am my... I'm doing this. Yes. Well, we see what the challenges you have, Jan, are going to be unique.
I'm not bringing chocolate into the discussion.
Because of my unselfishness, I'm going to give this chocolate to my body. Not
yes.
me. Not
yes.
me.
No, right.
Not me. I'll do without it. But the body, I'm going to give it to the body.
I'll give it as an offering.
As an offering. To the self.
Yes.
You know, that's fun, but it's also true. Mm-hmm. That can work.
Can it really?
That can work. Yeah, that could do it. Even in that, you could do it. So, at all times, our dryness of soul, that means when it's no fun, we don't want to do the work. When we have that disrelish of God, when, you know, when we'd rather go out and have fun, we'd rather not do our practice. He says, yes, and even when we fall into unfaithfulness and actual sin, bring God into all of your activities. I can't stress to you enough, I mean all. Mm-hmm. I mean drag him right down into the deepest part of your mud. Bring that presence in there. It's your only hope.
It'll make you think twice before you do it.
Yeah, it's your only rope out. And if you forget God, if you'd rather go and just not think about God, you're forgetting the rope. You're not going to be able to climb out of the hole. Yeah, you're not going to be able to do it. Because without him, the soul can do what? Nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. So if you choose to go into your vices and into your dark places alone, and to keep the thought of God peripheral and outside of yourself, you're giving up your hope. You're giving up your ability to change. Don't do it. Don't do it. carry God into it, sit there and tell him, I'm so embarrassed, I can't believe I'm doing this in front of you, oh my God, this is awful, you know, but I'm doing it, I feel driven to do it, and you can start to, God will automatically cause you to start discerning, discriminating, I'm doing it, I just like it, God, what do you like in it? Because God's going to ask you, why are you doing this? Not because he's judging you, because he's watching it happen, he wants to know what's going on. And you tell him, and that through that discernment, you come to realize the name of God hidden in your vices, and you can let go of them and take the name alone. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm. Take him everywhere. Do not forget him for any reason. All right, and that's that one. We'll stop there for the day.